Blog Talk Radio.
There's so many firefighters that will ask you, Glenn, where do you get to see this stuff?
Right, you're not aware.
You know, with the internet and Google and things, you can get on there and find some of these museums, some of these things to go see. And it's just, man, make sure you bring your camera. Like I talked about, the one in Oklahoma City is incredible. I mean, there's all these little jewels out there, if you will, when it comes to looking at some of the stuff we used to use way back when. And it's just, it's exciting. You know, you mentioned getting into the 1700s. Talk about Ben Franklin for a minute, because I always joke about years ago sitting at FDIC, in general sessions, opening session, and Ben Franklin, I say, you know, not the real one. This is the actor. The real one's dead. But and they laugh. But, you know, this young firefighter was sitting next to me and leaned over and said, "What's with the old guy?" And I said, "That's Ben Franklin." He goes, "Ben who?" I said, "Dude, I don't have enough time for a history lesson here. If you don't know who Ben Franklin is, talk to us a little bit about his impact on the American Fire Service."
Sure. Well, you know, Ben Franklin, of course, in American history is the guy. I mean, besides, of course, Washington and perhaps people later on, but we talk about Ben Franklin, all the things that he was involved with. Some people aren't aware that he was involved in the field of fire protection. And basically, he gets his start in the 1730s, creating a group of men who lived in Philadelphia who recognized the problem of unchecked fire, basically, and decided to form an association of mutual assistance, basically, to help each other in the case of a fire. And, of course, that meant that they all bought their own buckets and bought their own poles and things like that, so that if there was a fire in one of their homes, that they would actually respond and put the fire out and that kind of thing. And you know, it became quickly evident that there was need for firefighting, basically, and that these collective groups really did a decent job at dealing with it, and really was the birth of the American Fire Service, really, in Philadelphia, and specifically in 1736, Ben creates the Union Fire Company, again, union meaning group and together and that kind of thing, to provide fire protection for the neighborhood in which he lived. I mean, it pretty quickly got beyond the handful of people, you know, that they were protecting, basically. They essentially protected the entire neighborhood. This sort of goes along the lines we talked about fire marks on the other previous programs, in that that the American Fire Service is much different, in that we, even those early days, recognized that, hey, you know, we got to help our neighbors and that kind of thing. So Ben creates the first Union Fire Company in 1736, and it really, if you want to point to a specific time or year in which American firefighting started, it's usually the best one to look at date-wise.
I always use this thing, Glenn, I know you do too, as to, you know, just for that young firefighter who was sitting next to me saying, "Well, what's with the old guy?" I mean, if you look and list it, you know, the list, I'm sorry, of the things that this guy accomplished, I mean, they refer to him as the first American diplomat, ambassador, storyteller, published scientist, postmaster general, inventor, and economist.
Right.
He organized the first lending library, the first medical center, for you EMS folks out there, the first scientific society, the first philosophical society, the first volunteer fire department, the first fire insurance company. He invented the lightning rod bifocals, the static electric generator, and the Franklin stove, and he was the only American founding father who signed all four of the major documents that established American independence: the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty with France, the Treaty with England, and the Constitution, all at the risk of being hung for doing that. I mean, the next time a young firefighter sits next to you and says, "What's with the old guy?" You know, that's the kind of stuff that you need to look at, right?
No, definitely. And he was very prolific on all fronts. And, you know, people don't recognize the depth of how many things he was involved with and everything. And just remarkable person. I just throw a quick funny note about Ben Franklin. And it's sort of funny, I guess, today we think about it. But His son actually ended up being governor of New Jersey before the Revolution, and
really,
unfortunately, his son was on the Tory side of the Revolution. So, he wasn't a supporter of the new, you know, newly created American government, revolutionary government. So it was he had his own issues in his private life as well. So. But yeah, Ben was the beginning of this whole thing, and that's why you see so many references to Ben at firefighting and
Father of the Fire Service.
Yeah, the fire, because it really was. I mean, in a sense that he really, I mean, there was firefighting going on before that, but he's the one that really brought together a more organized manner, basically. And
well, and you hit him, you know, those famous volleys, you know, from with Ben Franklin, and
sure.
I know we talked about the fire marks, and we got that story
right.
Straightened out, thank goodness.
Right. Well, here's another one for you too with Ben Franklin. Many of you will see an image, a painting of Ben Franklin wearing a fireman's hat, and the unfortunate thing about that painting is, of course, that it was done in the 1800s with a helmet, what we call a New York style helmet, with the, you know, one traditional helmet, leather helmet with the helmet front piece and everything else. That helmet is about 150 years too late for Ben.
Because you have it listed, Glenn, in the, what was it, the late 1700s, was it Turk in New York?
Right.
Right, created the first fire
right.
cap?
Right. So, yeah, and actually that didn't look
fire
so
cap.
Much like the 19th century one. So there's a painting out there. You'll see a Ben Franklin wearing a fireman's helmet and stuff with the high eagle and 8-inch front and stuff like that. That it may be, you know, philosophically a great connection for Ben, but Ben would have never even known that hat because it wasn't created, like they said.
But you know, it adds some flair, and the fire service has never been one for, you know, embellishing or adding any fluff. It's
no,
like
never.
I said, it's like my a couple of my buddies in Chicago, and we were just talking about the whole red and green light in the front of firehouses
right.
and rigs, and the black of red rigs, and there are so many the stories. You know, it's almost as good as the O'Leary cow kicking over a lantern, which didn't happen.
Sure.
It's, you know, well, it had to do with steam or the horses and port and start. You know, it had to do with the commissioner back then, Goodbrick, I think his name was, in 33 or something, coming in from the waterways and brought over that tradition that they had with the tugs of black over red and the red and green. I've never seen a firehouse moving down the street, but some of my buddies used to say, well, it had to do with the cheese buggy and then with the steam on the or the horses. I'm going, okay. It's the same thing with, you know, and Ben looks good, the helmet. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he looks
No, he does. He looks good, and it just, he wouldn't have known it, but that's okay. So.
Well, and then we've got, in 1799,
right.
Manhattan Company began placing the first wooden water mains.
Yep.
In
that
New
was
York.
The, we talked a little bit about that last week, but that's the irony of early American history after the Revolution that, there was such a desire in our capitalist society to create banks, and there were major impediments to that. And so a lot of some of our founding fathers, Hamilton and Burr and some of the others, really saw the need for a banking system. And the way they saw to actually create that was through a water supply company.
Really?
Because the water supply company, of course, could then borrow money and do all sorts of things with financial resources. And so the Manhattan Water Company was essentially a front for a bank, basically. And of course, they were not particularly effective at putting in the water mains and actually having a usable water supply system. And they were usurped years later by some other companies and eventually by the city of New York itself by the 1830s, and the city really recognized that it was growing so much that it needed to have its own water supply.
Well, and that's why I was plugging and guilting my buddy, Chief Kenny Gabriel up at Coeur d'Alene, to go get Roger Leverins. It's still their old piece of the water main with the fire plugs in it.
Exactly,
and,
the wooden water mains. And I think we mentioned this on an earlier show, but it bears mentioning again that the Manhattan Water Company, of course, essentially did become a bank because it's what we call Chase Manhattan Bank today. And actually it's Chase,
really?
J.P. Morgan, I think now is its current name and stuff. But it had its origins, Manhattan had its origins in water, actually, and not in banking. But of course, that's you know, that's part of American history. So.
But you know, that's the stuff that a lot of folks don't realize, the connections. I mean, you know, just when I was riding around with John, when John took my family for a little tour,
sure,
the whirlwind tours I'm talking in Manhattan, where everything from where the original Wall Street was to,
right,
you know, the oldest church. I mean, all these different things. I mean, and I'm telling you, about half of what you look at somehow has a tie to the fire service.
Yep.
When you look at what we were doing back then.
Yep.
I mean, we talked about Hugh Halligan, right?
Right.
And I mean, this is the man that created the Halligan bar for the
right.
I mean, I, you know,
right.
Glennie, I've got one sitting in my office right here. That, you know, it, and you know when you've got one is you'll you, what's that? I mean, on the fork,
right.
Is his name,
right? And his signature, actually.
His signature, exactly. And Chris DeLizio, lieutenant in FDNY, and really good friend of John Salka's, sent it to me as a gift, and it sits in my office. And when this thing's so powerful, all you gotta do is wave it in front of the door and it opens. You don't even have to touch it to the door. But there's guys out there that have those on rigs that don't know they're there.
Yeah, actually, you look on them and you can actually see the imprint in the cast of Hugh Halligan's signature actually on it.
And he used to make these, right?
He made them himself.
Out of his apartment,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah, he made them himself. And a friend of mine, unfortunately, has since passed away. Some of your listeners may remember Chief Bill Comer from Patterson Fire Department in Jersey. Just a wonderful person. And for those of you who've ever seen the movie Lean on Me,
mm-hmm.
About Eastside High School in Patterson, there was an actor who portrayed him, but really didn't. It wasn't really him, though, in the sense that it actually acted like Bill Comer did. But Bill actually, in his collection, had not only the original Halligan bar, but Hugh Halligan actually put together a booklet on how to use the Halligan bar.
Really?
Yeah, and he had one of those in his collection as well. And I've only seen it once, and that was it in his collection. So.
Well, and that's become a problem, Glenn. And you talk to the guys in the FDNY, you know, I know he's retired now, but Chief John Norman, another legend, and
sure.
Vinny Dunn and Chief Dunn and all the different folks, Donnie Hayde, they'll tell you that it's almost become a lost art. You'll see with their was it WNYF? Is that
the New York Firefighters, right? That's
yeah, that they've actually got they've got articles in there, don't they? Because with the rabbit tool and with, you know, these hydraulic tools for doors,
sure.
The Halligan bar in some cases has become a lost art where. Yeah, it's something. There's a million different things you can do with it, and
right.
You still need to know. And it's probably one of the most versatile tools out there.
Right, right. It always starts too. So.
And you don't need something that weighs 165 pounds and
right.
And you know the Swiss Army tools you see that thing.
Right.
You show me a firefighter that, you know, knows that tool and they could do just about anything.
Right. Exactly. And you know, it is a universal tool and it has so many applications that. It's still the basic tool of most firefighters. I mean, it's the tool. It's been tried and true, and we have all these specialized devices nowadays and things like that. But it is still the critical piece of equipment that most firefighters should be carrying with them.
Oh, it's every firefighter. That's one of those things you should see. In fact, there's a lot of great tool companies. I know Bob from Firehooks has probably one of the most accurate with the. Not to plug another business, but it's, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, that good tools are good tools, and you can get something that's really, really close to that bar that's made in a good way with a good ads end on it and a good fork end and the right length is, you know, and again, it's a great tool, like you say, and we just don't train our firefighters enough on how to use it nowadays. Glenn, another thing you had on the list that when we did the class, you talked about the first fire hose company that was organized in Philadelphia in 1803. 1815, the waterworks opened in Philadelphia. You had mentioned that. And the first fire hydrant in 1817. Now, you mentioned 1829 is the first steam fire engine built by, and how do you say that? Braithwaite.
The way you pronounce it. Yeah, that was the first steam fire engine because it was steam engines in general were pretty popular at that point. I mean, they were running factories, they were doing all sorts of things, but again, as we mentioned earlier in this program, there was pushback from the fire service on these steam engines. They were contraptions that were to be feared for a lot of reasons. And
well, some of them, didn't they cause, I mean, and some of these things blew up and actually killed fire.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that over the years, steam fire engines, of course, are boilers on wheels. And, you know, they're dangerous. I mean, especially if one were to alter or disable the pressure relief devices, you can have an explosion. And, you know, that did happen. That did happen. That happened even after with the creation of the paid fire departments, too. There's a famous Leslie's Illustrated News, which was a 19th century newspaper, basically, with these wonderful woodcuts and illustrations and things. There's an illustration of actually one of these steamers blowing up at a theater fire in New York.
Yes.
And it killed several people surrounding this engine. So, like I said, they were dangerous. Who really pushed them actually was the insurance industry, because they realized that the insurance people realized that that was the future for firefighting, was probably more effective. And even though there were the dangers associated, it was more effective perhaps.
Who was Hodge and Worthington then?
They were later on. They were all different developers, basically.
Okay.
Brewis was English, basically. And
okay.
There were other people here in America who also created the steam fire engines. Again, because they were creating steam engines for other things. They just basically put it on wheels and put a pump on it. And essentially, that's what you end up with. But the real push for steam fire engines comes from Cincinnati. A guy by the name of Miles Greenwood, who was their first chief, basically realized that, again, steam was the future at that point. And in one fell swoop, Cincinnati ended up with one of the first really true paid fire departments in the country, and also one of the first fully equipped steam engine fire departments. So we owe it to Cincinnati as far as breaking the mold from hand pumpers to steamers. That's really where it took place. And then by that point, you know, in the 1850s, other cities like Philadelphia was an early advocate. Even New York City, you know, we think about New York City being, you know, rejecting the steam fire engine. By the 1860s, by 1865, the bulk of the engine companies in Manhattan had already converted over to using steam fire engines.
And that was, I mean, like you said earlier, to try and get, I mean, you think change, I mean, change is the biggest problem in the fire service. Tom Freeman said that for years. I mean, that had to be monumental to get some of these guys to go from, you know, from hand pump to steam, just like it was from pulling them to horses. And,
right.
You know,
right.
That had to be monumental.
It was. And there was still a lot of pushback. But you know what? It was recognized that this was a better way of doing things. And perhaps some of the firemen felt that if they went to steamers, that would delay the creation of paid fire departments and things. Who knows what, you know, exactly what they were thinking back then, but it was the transition at that point. But Cincinnati was the place for that, if you want to pick one spot where it really set that in motion.
Well, you know, and there's like I say, you've mentioned, I mean, think of all the departments already in just a couple of shows you've mentioned that have had such an impact on a fire service.
Sure.
You know, between, you know, you mentioned Patterson a couple of times, and then you know, obviously FDNY and Philadelphia and now Cincinnati, and there's been a bunch of others. And we talked about, you know, when the telegraph got started, and, you know, you got that going in 1845. And for those fire protection folks out there, 1852, you have the first patent issued for perforated pipe fire extinguishing system, the forerunner
right.
to automatic sprinklers.
Right. That was before there, you know, we think of sprinklers today as individual heads, sprinkler heads that spray water individually. Before that, the thought was that, you know, we need to put fires out, and especially this is a time when buildings are getting taller and further away from the pumpers in the street, basically, in the beginning of the steamers. And, you know, there was a need to be able to put water on the fire quickly, of course. And so we end up in a situation where someone got the bright idea to actually take pipes and drill holes in it at different angles, and so that during a fire, you actually could open a valve on the first floor and allow water to go up to that particular floor and spray water all over the place.
Well, you know, there's, to be honest, it's kind of funny because I've been to some training facilities, Glenn.
Yes.
That do live burns.
Right.
With
open sprinkler heads.
Yeah.
Right. And essentially, that's not that much different than the perforated pipe.
Yeah.
It's just the perforated pipe had a gazillion of these little holes, basically. And it would put this, you know, maybe, actually, Rick, maybe that was the first water mist system. I don't know.
You never know.
But there were a lot of them. There were still in Manhattan. Occasionally, you'll see a reference to one in Manhattan. They were used in basements a lot and everything. And they actually, in those cases, the basement-only systems actually just had a fire department connection. Of course, there's no water in it normally, and so the fire department would actually hook up to the perforated pipe system and pump water into it. And, of course, the water goes spraying all over the place. So, but it was the first one, and, of course, people recognized that, you know, that's not perhaps, even with a small fire, that's not the greatest thing to be spraying water over the entire floor, basically.
No, no.
And that's really led a guy by the name of Henry Parmalee to develop what we would consider to be the first modern sprinkler system with individual heads, basically, or wax-activated heads, basically, in his piano factory in New Haven, Connecticut.
Well, there you go. We always try to mention, I mean, we've talked about, we'll get a little bit further down the road with it, but we'll refer to October as Fire Prevention Month, but every month should be Fire Prevention Month. And for some of the fire prevention folks out there and planning folks, that's awesome information. We're visiting with Professor Glenn Corbett. Glenn, he's a professor at John Jay College and assistant fire chief at Waldbrook, New Jersey Fire Department, technical editor for Fire Engineering Magazine, our good friend. And just so many things. Glenn, we got about 5 minutes or so, and then we're going to break this show off and get to you on our next one. Let's jump ahead here just a little bit. First aerial ladder developed by, Hayes?
Yeah, Daniel Hayes from the San Francisco Fire Department. There were aerial ladders before that. We think about ladder trucks. For many years, the ladders were just basically straight ladders, you know, and if they were, it was a 40-foot ladder, it was a 40-foot long ladder with no...
Could you imagine?
Right. So the ladder trucks became particularly difficult. I mean, if you look at the earliest hand-pulled ladder trucks, they actually had a tongue on both ends of the apparatus, so you could steer it, basically, because it was so long, okay? Because, again, no ropes, no extension ladders, basically. And so there was this obvious need as buildings got taller to have extension ladders, and specifically apparatus-mounted extension ladders. And so by the 1860s, you really see the creation of some of these, and unfortunately, some of them were very dangerous. One particular one killed several firefighters in New York during a demonstration. And it was really Daniel Hayes of the San Francisco shops, actually, volunteer fireman in San Francisco, and then later a paid fireman, and ran the shops there. He was the innovator of the, they called it the Hayes aerial ladder, basically. And it was the first real safe aerial ladder that was apparatus mounted. And, of course, in those days also, of course, there's no electricity on the apparatus, and there's no motors or anything like that to raise them. So they're all raised by hand, actually. So later some people got the great idea, and it was smart, to actually use springs, actually to help move that ladder up and things. So quite something.
And they had, I mean, I saw the cranks, and it's like we'll get the snorkels later with, you know, some of the everything hand-operated, like you said. Nowadays, we're complaining that the hydraulics don't move the ladder quick enough for us. and they were raising things by hand back then. Hey, you know, there's something I got to ask you about, especially before we get done here today. You know, I love fire poles. I think I know they can be dangerous if you're not paying attention, but they're just, you know, they're just cool. If my wife would let me, I put one in the house, I could make about 20 seconds on my response times to fires and stuff. But wood fire poles,
there's competition between various departments, New York, Chicago, and other departments, actually, and who had the first one. And I guess it depends on how you define it, you know. Of course, the wooden ones, as you can imagine, Rick, this kind of fell out of disfavor fairly quickly.
Well, I can't picture. I mean, I'm thinking right now, and I'm going through pain.
Right, just thinking about grabbing that thing and slide down, all of a sudden you get a bloody hand when it gets.
I can't keep myself sometimes from, you know, telling guys or myself from burning my hands on a brass pole by not hanging out right. I can't imagine sliding a wooden one.
Right, exactly. So, unfortunately, like I said, the brass poles were, or I should say the wooden poles pretty much quickly went out, and brass was adopted for many, many years. And of course, the tragedy of the brass pole today is, for those of us traditionalists and things who appreciate them, the days are coming to an end for brass poles, because New York City already is one of the biggest users of brass poles, has made the decision that no new firehouses will ever be built with brass fire poles anymore. So The ones that are out there right now in the existing houses are essentially it. So as those houses are taken offline, basically, that's going to be the end of the, at least in New York City, the end of the brass fire pole.
And here's a little, a kind of a cool little note. In Coeur d'Alene, you know, they've got the poles. They're not brass anymore.
Right.
In the main station. But from the original firehouses back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the brass poles, they actually kept them instead of letting somebody just scrap them and off they went. And not only are they a nice display to put somewhere, hopefully near your wall of flame that you've got with all your pictures and artifacts and everything in your firehouse, but the extra that they have, every time one of the members that actually slid that pole back then retired, they cut a piece and mounted to a plaque, and it was pretty cool, you know, to give them a piece of what they slid because no one's going to use them anymore. It's already been taken out of the firehouse.
Right.
They already have the one on display. So there was another cool idea, if you will, you know, when it came to celebrating what we're doing in the fire service.
Glenn,
I got a favor to ask you.
Sure.
Would you be willing to come back one more time? And there's notable events. There's so many other things that I'd love to discuss with you and have you tell the listeners. And I want to run an idea by you while I got you on the air. And what do you think? I mean, we've got notable fires to cover, which is really going to tell us why we're doing a lot of what we're doing.
Sure.
I use them in my pride and ownership classes every time, buddy.
Sure.
Things you've taught me. And again, I credit you with the majority of what I've got history-wise comes right from the Glenn Corbett archives.
Yeah, no problem.
But, you know, maybe we could do something for the listeners where maybe once a month, you know, we could get with Peter and let's do a show and let's pick one fire.
Okay.
You're getting ready now. You either did you just go visit or are you
Friday I'm headed out to Boyertown, Pennsylvania. Probably no one's ever heard of it other than our friends in the Philadelphia area. But Boyertown in January of 1908 was the scene of one of our worst public assembly fires. It was the second floor of an opera house, and a kerosene lantern went, a lamp went over, and tremendously, you know, bad fire, killed 179 people, and was one of the landmark fires in our collective fire service history. So they're having a commemoration this weekend, and actually I'm going to the event on Friday night at the Historical Society there, and just to hear about the fire and learn more about what happened and what have you. So. So yeah, if we want to, I think, maybe the listeners, if we haven't, you know, basically taken them too far down the history lane and things, certainly we could talk about, individual fires. We could focus.
Well, you know what I'm afraid of, Glenn, is if we only hit like each one,
right.
I just thought about us while we're talking. I'm
right.
You know, you've got so much information that I just want to get, and maybe I'm being selfish here, you know, but. You know, if we're able to take maybe one or two of these a show,
sure.
You know, like, and if we just talked about theater fires, I mean, not
right.
only could we get into the Opera House
right.
and the Brooklyn Theater and the couple others in the Iroquois,
right.
I mean, we can get into what happened on the Great Chicago Fire and in Wisconsin, and we can kind of tie it, maybe do one show and cover a, you know,
sure.
let's talk about how we are where we're at places of public assembly, how we are with theaters, how we
sure.
are with the whole natural gas thing. I mean, and take some time and really give some folks, you know, tie it together because I don't want to rush. This is just incredible.
Sure.
I would hate to rush through. So if you're good with that, if Peter's
sure.
good with that, maybe folks, that's what we'll do for you is we'll come back with Glenn next show. We'll finish up notable events in the fire service, or we'll try to, and then we'll come back and maybe hit you once a month with a different cadre of events that maybe, like you say, Glenn, maybe we'll do theaters.
Sure.
And because, God, there's so many things that people go, well, why do we do what we do? Well, here's four or five.
Sure.
I mean, Triangle, sure. Well, there's all these different things that have affected how we do what we do.
Sure.
I just wouldn't want to rush through it. So if you're good with that, buddy.
No, we're good to go.
Oh, that's awesome. So, well, Glenn, I can't thank you enough. I mean, we'll come back and hit you one more time here with our next show and do, I think it'll be part four.
Right.
A lot of great feedback already. Folks, keep sending us your emails. Again, rick@prideandownership.com or, you know, work address rlasky@cityoflouisville.com. And you know how to get a hold of Professor Glenn. Glenn, thank you so much, buddy.
Thank you, Rick.
This is my honor, buddy.
Mine too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Well, appreciate it. That wraps